Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we are back talking Northern Ireland history, the Troubles, and how do we put this, Martin? How do we talk about what actually happened and make sure that it's actually given full transparency, dragged out into the light of day, and truth and reconciliation means more than just a catchphrase?
I think it's a big ask, Tony. I think it's a huge ask, particularly when the British government is not terribly aware of its own history. So I think
can I say, I think they're very aware of their own history. I just, when you see, though, you know, statute of limitations been introduced recently to put the possibilities of actual people who carried out some of the atrocities being put out beyond the statute of limitations, you'd have to worry about that. Look, you don't, nonetheless, it doesn't really matter what me and you think, because we're actually joined by an expert here. We have, long-time listeners will remember, we spoke to Gareth Mulvenna, who is the Troubles historian. He has written some of the best pieces around on loyalism, unionism, the reaction, the gangs, the Tartan Gangs book. He's written My Life in, he was co-wrote My Life in Loyalism with Billy Hutchinson as well. Gareth, first of all, thanks so much for coming back on the podcast.
Well, thanks for asking me. It's I'm glad I behaved myself for the first time, so welcome back.
Not at all. It was really went over very well with our listeners, that perspective. That and I'm going to start on the context of recent developments. Obviously, the British government have said that they want to commission a series of historians to come in and account, an official account between the 60s and the present, up to the Good Friday Agreement of the Troubles. You've kind of been doing that work already, Gareth.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, it's always interesting when these projects are announced, because, you know, I suppose whether people like to admit it or not, there's probably a mad scramble in people's minds to sort of pitch for the gig. Now, the interesting thing here is I've actually been involved in a project quite similar to this one. Although maybe not just as controversial in terms of the scope. Recently, the Centenary Committee, headed by Lord Bew, were involved in putting together an edited collection on the centenary, the 100 years of Northern Ireland. And the book basically was to cover different themes. I mean, the early part of the book covers issues relating to partition, the setting up of Northern Ireland, that type of thing. I was actually quite surprised to get an email, and I was asked to write a chapter on youth culture in Northern Ireland. So it was like a really big honour to be asked that, because obviously a lot of the stuff I did in the Tartan Gangs, and more broadly, I've got an interest in youth culture. So that was obviously sponsored by the Northern Ireland Office. And, you know, it's the first time I'd done that type of work, commissioned by a government or government body or department. It was a sort of like whistle-stop tour of the subject. So I had, you know, 2,000 words to write about 100 years of youth culture. So it wasn't easy, but it was the same for everybody doing chapter. Now, when I got the draft back, there'd been no interference by the Northern Ireland Office. Okay, the subject I was looking at was very uncontroversial. But this new project, the proposal for an official history of the Troubles, it leaves me feeling a wee bit more sort of cynical for a variety of reasons, which we'll probably get into.
I'd definitely like to delve into that cynicism, but if I could, I'd like to ask you know, given recent events, we're coming up on the 50-year anniversary in January of Bloody Sunday, and we've seen some of the situations around that, how that was been handled, and how there was alternative histories. I mean, you've written the book on the Tartan Gangs. You've written the book with Billy Hutchinson, and you continue to write great pieces. You were writing only yesterday about about some violent acts that were carried out on two individuals. So those stories are going to be problematic, especially in the basis of if people really are interested in bringing this forward, because we spoke to Sam McElwain, and Sam's is a terrific advocate for unionism and progressive unionism, if I can use that phrase. But he's also adamant that there's no, you know, that we some of the things we would like to pursue just aren't for him. So you're going to be writing things that people won't want to come to the table at all about Gareth.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, in terms of the scope of what they're trying to do, is it just a sort of history of Operation Banner? Is it a history of, you know, I mean, obviously the idea of this project seems to be to counter Republican, what is described as a Republican whitewashing or rewriting of history. And look, you know, the thing that strikes me here is that every actor in the conflict is entitled to remember the conflict in the way they experienced it. So if Republicans are seen to be rewriting the conflict, that shouldn't come as any surprise to people who aren't Republicans, just in the same way that people who support the UDR, who support the British Army, who are proud of those forces, will obviously have a very different take on those forces to people in the Catholic community. So how you can ever find an official history, and there's been this talk of independent historians being brought on board under Privy Council. Now, forgive me, and this is where the cynicism comes in, but I don't really think there is anything in the world as such a thing as an independent historian, because everybody comes to the table with their own political baggage, their own emotional baggage, their own feelings about what they're writing about. I mean, I've openly described how, when I was doing the Tartan book, I had to sort of immerse myself in, you know, trying to find some sort of empathy for what it would have been like to be a young loyalist engaged in violence at that time. For me, as a Catholic from North Belfast, I've mentioned that loads of times, it was an uncomfortable thing to do. It was an uncomfortable thing to inhabit, because I was, you know, and my parents and, you know, whatever, were the people that these people wanted to kill at that time in the early 70s as part of the strategy to deter support for the IRA. So, you know, everybody has baggage to some extent. So to talk about independent historians, I'm sure there are eminent historians who will come along after me and criticize me for saying this, but I don't think there's any such thing as an independent or impartial commentator on the Troubles.
There's not a scientist that would disagree with you. Sorry, Martin, I know you wanted to come in. Going to interrupt the podcast for that moment that you don't like, but we have to do. It is us asking you to support this project, the wider platform, all of the voices you hear and the stories you hear. It's been an unbelievable week, a few weeks actually. And some of the things we've done, they've really made a difference. I've been contacted by Nadim to say that, you know, we're getting more traction on his case and his leave to remain. I've gotten messages from Kira saying that she's been in contact with people in the Dublin Regional Homeless Executive, people from the government itself, and people from the opposition. Those things that we do, and we pile on and we fight for it and we try and help amplify, they matter, but they don't actually happen unless we can keep the platform viable. And at the moment, we just aren't. We haven't been, we're not. And it's more difficult for me. It's more difficult to keep this going because there's more bills and I just have no other income stream at this stage. So if you're one of the thousands of people listening every day, it just means you have to put your hands in your pocket and help us out. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. It really would make all the difference. Just a couple of quid keeps the mics on, keeps us being able to talk to those people. And we'll just go from there. Please, if you can, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Let you go back to the podcast.
Yeah, it's separate histories, really, Gareth. I mean, there are a number of separate histories running in tandem with each other that have crossover points, but are very separate histories.
Definitely. And I mean, this is one of the issues. I mean, I'm on the advisory panel for this new proposed Troubles Museum in Northern Ireland. And, you know, I tried to explain it to some of the people who maybe didn't have the same amount of knowledge as people who are across all the details. But you're quite right there, because on the one hand, you've got a lot of, the idea of trying to create a central museum, and this sort of ties in with the idea of an official history. The idea of trying to create one museum to cover the Troubles is admirable, and there might be a way of doing it. But the difficulty is how to marry those different narratives and bring them all together in one sort of, you know, central space. Now, those different narratives that you mentioned, I mean, they're all very interesting, taken in isolation. You've got the Ronnie McCauley Museum in West Belfast. You've got the Eileen Hickey Museum in Conway Mill. You've got the Andy Turry Interpretive Centre on the Newton Arch Road. You've got the Ballymac Centre on the Newton Arch Road. You've got the ACT Initiative on the Shankill Road, just to mention a few in Belfast. And these obviously look at things from very different perspectives. And they're both completely valid perspectives on Republican and Loyalist history. It's the same if you go to the Imperial War Museum. I mean, the Imperial War Museum will have a certain narrative, obviously, about Britain's role in foreign conflict. Now, I mean, I was posed this question by one of the senior people who is trying to organise this museum. And they, obviously, knowing that I'm interested in Loyalism and have contacts within Loyalism, spoke about the idea of doing seminars up at Queen's and getting these stakeholders in to sort of pitch the idea of the museum. And they said, well, could you get people in from, you know, do you think people, Loyalists and Republicans, would sit in the same room? And I said, absolutely they would. There's no problem with that. But try and get people from the UVF and the UDA to sit in the same room. And that's where it could become difficult. You know, so there are these nuances that people don't really understand when they're trying to take a corporate approach to the history here. And, you know, that's what worries me about what the British government are proposing.
Like, you know, there could be a case for saying having a history from a human rights perspective, because we recognize what international human rights are about. So at least you have a framework to work from. But to write a political history is just sounds so fraught with subjectivity, I think is the right way to put it.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, in terms of what the British are trying to do, and again, more will emerge over the coming months, I'm sure, in terms of the detail and what they hope to achieve. But I mean, there was a valid point being made. I forget by who exactly, but you know, young people younger than me, you know, and people in their 30s and 20s might not realise, you know, when the British Army came into Northern Ireland, they were welcomed by the Catholic community. I mean, that's something that might surprise young Republicans now who maybe aren't across the history. They were also despised by Loyalists, you know, and that's another sort of contradiction that runs through the sort of history of the Troubles and the fabric of the Troubles. But although you talk about human rights, we have all these narratives about collusion, and undoubtedly there was collusion. But it's also important to recognise and challenge Loyalists about their adversarial role against the army, and how they, you know, had pitched battles with the army and took the army on. And that's, from an outsider's perspective, that's a sort of strange paradox that maybe can never be sort of fully...
Yeah, it's not something that registers. See, this is it. We'd like it to be simplistic. We'd rather, can you give us can you not just give us something that says those guys them were good and them were bad and let's move on? And we know that's not true, and we know, but we also don't trust the process, because like everybody's up in arms over the fact that this statute of limitations and this idea that people who actually did these things won't face any sanction. And you know, you only have to look at how, you know, some things that happened recently where, like let's say it was just injustice. It was absolutely injustice. We will be talking to Tony Doherty in the next the next day or two about the scenario. Coming up to the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, and I don't want to keep going harping on about one situation, but that one stands out as something that, you know, the British government definitely backed away from. And you saw stuff online about, you know, about the actual victims of this and how it wasn't reported on. But Gareth, within Loyalism and within Unionism, I'm actually hopeful, and it's probably only hopeful because I talked to you and Sam and the guys, and I find that there's actually a willingness to have some sort of understanding of why people were motivated to do the things they do, what it meant, because particularly now in this context of where we are, whether people want to believe it or not, there's momentum that won't be shifted in many directions towards whether it's a border poll or whether it's broadening of a shared island or whatever is going to happen. There has to be a sense of cultural identity, of unionism, loyalism, and a telling of that truth. And it's a big challenge because there's warts and all.
Yeah, I mean, again, going back to, you know, looking at that period that I'm particularly interested in. And I'm really worried, more so than I was back in April, about the situation that's emerging. And it's only because I'm revisiting that period of the early 70s and the 60s and trying to see, look, this term back, the Protestant backlash, the loyalist backlash, you know, people accuse me of sort of apologizing, you know, this, that, and the other based on the title. But when you go back through the papers, this was being used constantly by a lot of different people. And, you know, the thing that really depresses me and really gets me despondent about the future here is the fact that a lot of the stuff that was being said in 1960s, early 1970s by unionist politicians is being said still in the year 2021, and people are still falling for the same rhetoric. And a lot of the rhetoric is very dangerous. And as history has shown us, it's not the politicians that will end up in jail. It's not the politicians' children that will end up in jail. It's the young working class guys who get swept up in the trouble. Some who have very, you know, who can articulate the political cause. Others who get swept up in it in recreational terms for a sense of identity. And look, if one working class person from any side of the divide or any person ends up in jail or ends up dead, you know, this is going to be, it's not worth it. None of the political rhetoric or the border or the protocol, none of that is worth a human life. But I'm beginning to see there's a lot of anger and loyalism, and I'm beginning to see a lot of worrying parallels with the situation that happened here 50 years ago. And as you might have noticed last night, I was reading the journalist the late Seamus Kelter's memoir, and in the first page he talks about his mum buying a house in West Belfast in the 1960s, one of the new builds, and her mother saying, "Why would you want to live in Belfast? What about the Troubles?" And she was basically saying, "Well, the Troubles were 40 years ago, and that was in the 1960s. So Irish history, as we all know, comes around in cycles. But we never seem to learn any of the horrible lessons. And that was the quandary that I was having last night, where I've long been interested in the motivations of people who got involved in violence and showing empathy towards them. But increasingly, as time's gone on, I'm trying to find a way of marrying up that narrative, that experience, with the experience of victims and survivors, and how there's this horrible interface between people who live in the same city, who have the same experiences, who really, at the end of the day, are only divided by tradition. And tradition really is something that, you know, people should be able to have ownership of, you know, enjoy, act out on. But it shouldn't divide people to the point where they're killing each other in a place like in Northern Ireland or the UK or Ireland. And I have to say, I'm feeling a lot more despondent than I was, you know, 7 months ago.
But that's, do you not think that's understandable too, when we're looking at the current situation where you have Professor Harvey is effectively blocked from a position, a political block.
It's political. It's political interference.
Yeah, and then you're talking about creating a singular history of Northern Ireland, and you know I don't think people like you, Gareth, will be the first to be asked. I think you should be the first to be asked, but as you said, there's going to be jockeying for position. And as these things go in the British establishment, you know, it'll be an old Etonian heading it up. And, you know, that slant is there from the very beginning.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a lot of projects that I, you know, and again, that there's a danger of coming across as somebody with sour grapes or, you know, sort of like, oh, you know, that sort of hackneyed thing where, you know, oh, it didn't work out for me, so, you know, I'm cynical just based on that because, you know, I never got into academia. But, yeah, I mean, I'm not the only one who would feel that way, where you look at people who are shoved into positions of, you know, well-paid jobs and writing these official histories and, you know, all these type of really cushy gigs. And sometimes you look at them and you think, they're not really the best place people to be doing them. But, you know, if you dare come out and criticize any of them, you're seen as...
But Gareth, you get more true, as you said, your connections and loyalism. You get more, say, for example, talk to Sean Murray and about his connections in the nationalist community. You can go through all of those things. Again, I mentioned Tony Doherty earlier and his lived experiences. And there's loads of voices there. And there's to be female voices, you know, there has to be all of that. Yeah, yeah. All of that has to be represented. But what's really you know, that's why, it, as Martin is right to point out, there's no singular retelling. You know, this is the nonsense of, if we want to be really blunt about it, and we use a modern day thing where people can understand, they want you to, you know, the American version of 9/11 is that it happened when the planes hit the towers. Let's not talk about how we got to that point, you know? So yeah, we have to be much more nuanced than that. Your writing actually is quite nuanced, and I would advise people check it out. Gareth, you've set up a Buy Me a Coffee account where you can read your essays as well. So yep. Look, we'll put that in at the end. But I just want to ask you about that sense of despondency and that sense of just, you feel a little bit less enthusiastic about the future because of the things that have happened. We've seen attacks on, I mean, we spoke to Brian Smith from the Greens, and he killed me now for saying this, but I think when we were off air, he made the comment that maybe the bus company were for the protocol or something, because they just keep hitting the buses, you know. But it does seem that it is, again, working class communities undermined on the basis and exposed for this, when the reality, as you know, Gareth, is that it's poverty, it's inequality, it's lack of educational attainment, it's lack of resources, and it's they don't see a future. So sure, I might as well throw this thing here, you know. That is a dangerous cocktail, if I may use that term. Is there pushback within the community to say, no, let's not do that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, and people like Billy, you know, who myself and Sam are obviously very close to, you know, he would be one of the, I mean, okay, I'll give you an example. You know, last week I was around, you know, visiting my parents, and my mum said, I see Billy Hutchinson doesn't support peace anymore. And I was like, no, what Billy has said is that the Belfast Agreement isn't working for loyalists anymore. He still supports the peace process, but not the framework that it's operating under at the moment.
Actually, can I come in on that? Because it's a 6-page statement. It's pretty seismic in terms of what it's saying around. Now, again, here we go. We even start in a problematic place because Billy refers to it as the Belfast Agreement, and I refer to it as the Good Friday Agreement. But nonetheless, he doesn't actually completely back away from it in the 6 pages. He doesn't support it. He seems to move his party away from it. That's problematic now, because, and I put it to you, Gareth, that the problem I have about it is not that so much that Billy's wrong in some of the criticisms he's had. I can see he has a lot of relevant points, but what we fail to recognize is that the Good Friday Agreement, or the Belfast Agreement, if you prefer, was never bloody implemented. So we can't back away from a thing that we never actually chose to implement.
Well, I think, you know, I mean, I obviously came of age during that Good Friday Belfast Agreement. It's the semantics. You're absolutely right about the semantics there, because, you know, I it's sort of like Derry, Londonderry. I always try and sort of just, you know, like, well, I...
Yeah, yeah. No, it's easier to say Derry. Let's tell the truth.
Yeah. Well, no, it is. I've never referred... I mean, I only refer to it as Londonderry when I feel under pressure in certain environments. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know. You're absolutely right. I mean, I came of age in that generation. I was at that, the Ash and U2 gig in the waterfront, and... You know, we were in school. I remember we had David Irvine in, Gerry Adams in the Politics Society. It was an amazing time to be interested in politics and sort of, you know, Blair and all this. And you were, I suppose, as a young person, you were being fed this narrative that, you know, everything's changed now. We can never go back. And over the 23 years since then, we've never implemented anything properly or at all. And the working class communities in Northern Ireland are further apart than ever. And yeah, and that's why I begin to worry about these potentials for history to reemerge, the horrible thing. And, you know, we've seen buses being burnt out. And initially I thought, look, you know, that's okay. That was a regular occurrence during the Troubles. It's awful. It shouldn't be happening. But that's why things started back in the 60s as well, just buses being burnt out, used as barricades. And then people began to get shot, and then people began to get blown up, and then people began to get taken out of cars and mutilated. And So it escalates very quickly from a very seemingly innocuous starting point. So how do we head it off the pass now? I don't think it'll ever happen again. But, you know, I'm very despondent. And the idea of doing a sort of the statute of limitations, the official history. I mean, going back to the official history, and sorry to meander a wee bit here, but one of the points I was thinking about before we came on and started chatting, I don't like official histories of anything. You know, it's a bit like when you go to football. I support Nottingham Forest. When I go over to the City Ground in Nottingham, I get the match day programme, but I know it's not going to tell me anything interesting. It's just going to be fluff pieces about the team. It's the same with any sort of corporate or official history. It's going to be fluff. It's not going to be going into the darker recesses or self-examination, I don't think. So if it doesn't do that, how can we ever learn from the mistakes that were made? And no matter how much people want to say Operation Banner was great, these were heroic guys, all you have to do is look at the places, you know, what happened in the Shankill in 1972 with the Parachute Regiment, where they committed murder. They murdered ordinary working class Protestants. And that's why in this day and age, you won't have the Parachute Regiment flag being flown in the Shankill, but you still won't have a lot of people coming out and saying, openly saying, we don't support the Parachute Regiment or Soldier F or whatever. So there is a fear still. And I was talking to a guy from Liverpool about this the other day. Working class prods, loyalists, talk about, you know, the Paphnutian Centre, you know, Rebels for Justice, all these different groups. And it's like, well, and it's a bit like the point I made about Sinn Féin, you know, talk about Sinn Féin getting everything and doing this and the other. Well, Sinn Féin knew in the early 80s that there was a different phase of the conflict that they could go on. They could take a political route and that they've been successful. And there's no point in being begrudging of people for doing that. If you think that the Rebels for Justice are whitewashing things or Paphnutian are whitewashing things, if that is your interpretation, well, why don't you set these organizations up yourself? Ask for inquiries. Ask for information on the four-step bombing, the Balmoral Furniture Shop, Kingsmill, all these different things. Go and do it. Don't rely on the government to do it, because they never will. They don't have your interest at heart, no matter if it's a Tory Prime Minister or Labour Prime Minister. You have to do it yourself. Start from the grassroots and say, instead of begrudging people, we're going to do it ourselves.
Nail on the head, Gareth.
Yeah.
Nail on the head. It's
something I feel very passionate about, because I, as I've explained before, myself and Beano Niblock do this thing, you know, we did do this thing where we go out and talk to people, mainly ex-combatants or ex-prisoners, and say, the one thing that always comes up is Republicans are rewriting history. And again, this ties in with the official history idea. Republicans are rewriting history, this, that, and the other. And you say to people, well, why don't you write your history, tell your history, even write it down for your families, do it in the form of creative writing, any medium to make sure that the record is there and you can feel that you set the record straight and balanced it out. And after that initial enthusiasm, you go back to people and they say, no, no, no. And it's the same, I mean, not to speak out of turn, but that book that the IRA prisoners were involved in, More Meekly Serve My Time, which is a really important record of prison life. I know certain loyalists have been trying to do a similar book for years to get loyalists to talk about their experience of the prison years, but they can't get people together to do it. They can't get people to have the confidence to write their stories down. And that's what I feel passionate about, because if you feel the historical narrative is being unbalanced or being whitewashed or whatever your interpretation is, do something about it. Don't complain about it. You know, there's no point in feeling sorry for yourself.
Would it be the case, just question, Gareth, would it be the case that the histories are oral, but the nationalist side has decided to put their oral history into writing, and that the loyalist side hasn't yet come to that point?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting point, because, you know, even the oral history is quite tricky now. And again, I'd warn against, you know, when we're talking about this subject, we can't just I don't want to be seen to be filtering it down just to the paramilitary experience, because we'll have to hear the ordinary people's experience. the people who were politically motivated in those communities but weren't involved in it in violence of any kind. And, you know, it strikes me that, you know, particularly with women on the loyalist side, and that's why I'm involved in that Her Loyal Voice website with Ellen Finlay. And we've always been passionate about getting women to feel confident about telling their stories, not being seen as sort of tea makers or people in the background, that it's important for them to tell their stories. So the oral history is important. In terms of the written history, you had back in 2014, Plum Smith publishing his book on his life and loyalism, as it were. Then I thought there would be a sort of floodgate of people feeling confident enough to tell their stories, but nothing emerged until myself and Billy did his story. And, you know, there are stories out there. There are stories and, you know, records and documents that could balance out the historical narrative. But there seems to be a lack of confidence in the loyalist community. And I think I've made the point before, you know, again, it comes to that idea that Sinn Féin and the Provisional Movement have been successful in creating a network of, you know, you've got the Fela, you've got the political party, you've got different support networks, which is completely legitimate. And I'm not critical of that. I think that's been a good way to come out of conflict. But loyalists haven't been able to do the same thing.
Well, so, can I speak in favor of loyalism for a second? It's very hard because you're on the one front, you're looking at the examples of Sinn Féin as you outlined their success, how they've, you know, relentlessly grown their vote, relentlessly moved on. They've grown the cultural events around the Fela. They've had these checkpoints. You know, you're at the point where Mary Lou MacDonald is saying, I don't care about flags. I care about healthcare. You know, all of these conversations, all these things that probably were, you couldn't have said 10 years ago in the Republican movement. But on the loyalist side, you've been betrayed by the Union in terms of the actual British government. And I'll put it to you that it's not just this government, but it's been a series of governments, and it's slowly, they've been unwinding the Union. So people who are loyal to the Union, the real problem in many ways is what was maybe the ties that bind have been not necessarily totally severed, but certainly damaged by the people on the other side of the water.
Yeah, and I mean, it goes back to something I was talking about the other day, the journalist from Liverpool, and it was about this idea of, you know, diminishing returns. And, you know, David Irvine once said to me that no unionist leader has, every unionist leader has overplayed their hand with the British government. And he said that to me 17 years ago, and he was absolutely right. And, you know, the way I was articulating it the other day, and again, I'm articulating this as a historian who studies loyalism and you know, would be close to the thinking in terms of, you know, having spent time with people who are loyalists and being friendly with them. I suppose the difficulty is that if you're constantly defending something, there is less and less room for new ideas to blossom, and that's one of the problems. Now, one of the points I was making the other day was, and again, it comes into the idea of the governments, the success of governments, and it's historical amnesia. Historical amnesia is a really big problem in Northern Ireland. Loyalism, you know, celebrates 1690, you know, all these different dates in the, you know, which are basically ancient history, but are absolutely important in the fabric of their cultural and religious identity, and that's good. But I remember back in 2013, wasn't it, when Maggie Thatcher died, there was that, you know, people talk about Twitter being toxic now. When Thatcher died, Twitter was a really interesting place to observe the sort of contradictory behaviours of people here. Now, on the one hand, you had Republicans celebrating Thatcher's death. And I mean, look, that's fine, because Thatcher, in my opinion, Thatcher, you know, ruined Britain. She didn't just ruin, you know, she didn't, you know, there was this idea that she was a strong arm against republicanism, which, I mean, has been shown to be a historical fallacy, you know, because there was back channel negotiations going on. She was a bit softer than was realized at the time. But loyalists were coming out and saying Thatcher was the greatest prime minister we had since Churchill. But it was only, you know, 30 years before Thatcher died that the same loyalists were coming out and protesting against her shining Britain away with the Anglo-Irish Agreement. Now, the Anglo-Irish Agreement bore witness to one of the, if not the largest protest rally at the City Hall, where Paisley famously said never, never, never. And that was in 1985 or whatever. And that Thatcher, that was Thatcher's hand behind that. Thatcher didn't care about these people. But yet, a couple of decades later, they're lauding her as the strong arm prime minister, the Iron Lady, the best prime minister that Britain ever had. You know, this, but, you know, that's, for me, that was a contradiction too far. And I had to challenge people on that and sort of say, well, wait a minute. Thatcher ruined Great Britain. She ruined the UK. She ruined working class communities, including working class communities in Northern Ireland. And on top of that, the cherry on the top of the icing was that she tried to give Northern Ireland away. So
let's put this in the context of the global world, because it was again, many of the Trump supporters say bring back Ronnie Reagan, and it's a well founded belief that the both of them helped usher in neoliberal capitalism unfettered. Because if you want to talk about economic damage that was done globally, that's one of the most interesting source points, is the both of their reigns coincided, and both of them were free market ideologists. So anyway, sorry, Martin, conscious.
I'll just mention, that taxation on the wealthy went from 90% down to lower than taxation on the poorest during that period as well. Sorry, I just had to mention that.
No, Gareth, absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming on and having this chat with us. As you've shown, history is fluid. It changes. It doesn't stand still. So I think at best what we can expect out of this is a picture of a mindset of history at a particular moment in time. But thank you for taking this time to have this conversation with us.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
No, listen, folks, I would, again, recommend. It's actually buymeacoffee.com/Gareth Mulvenna. The link, when you're listening to this podcast, the link will be in the blurb. So you just need to press it. Gareth writes regularly, puts up the essays, and it's well worth hitting it. As he says, it's the price of a cup of coffee. But honestly, open your bloody minds. And I'm saying that to you Free State bastards. We'll let you all go. We talk to you soon, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.